This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This episode is also brought to you by the Canby Liquor Store. Yep, they're still open. There's no scientific evidence that says that alcohol cures COVID, but hey, it's worth a shot, am I right? Find them at the Canby Fred Meyer Shopping Center. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Additional residents tested positive for COVID-19 Saturday at Countryside Living. Countryside is a privately owned long-term care facility. It is located in downtown Canby and it specializes in the care of those with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. The first case was confirmed 1 week ago, making the site the first confirmed COVID outbreak in Canby. 6 residents and 3 staff members have now tested positive for the novel coronavirus, for a total of 9 cases. Countryside has 51 residents as of this week. While Countryside staff and residents face the challenge of battling the infectious and potentially deadly coronavirus, the Canby community has come together to offer their support. Facility spokeswoman Michelle Quinn says they have been overwhelmed by the positive messages of encouragement, appreciation, and prayers. Some have even brought lunch for Countryside staff so they can focus on caring for residents. A new effort emerged this weekend as Terry Berkeley Gonzalez, sister of Countryside owner Eric Berkeley, and volunteers spent some time papering residents' outside windows with weatherproof hearts in a gesture of love and hope. It's part of a wider movement called World of Hearts. Gonzalez said, quote, "This was about loving our neighbors, specifically those who don't have the ability to really see their family and friends right now. We also wanted to thank those who serve in places like Countryside, who put themselves at risk each day and are providing love and care to the lonely, confined, and separated." Thus far, facilities staff have been successful in their strategy of isolating the outbreak to the larger North Building. Staff assigned to the North Building are not allowed to enter Countryside South, located across First Street, and vice versa. North Building employees who are concerned about the possibility of being exposed to the virus and spreading it to their loved ones or the community have been offered the use of Thelma's Place. Thelma's Place is the affiliated day respite program that has been suspended since last month by order of Governor Kate Brown. Thelma's Place, which is accessible to Countryside North via closed courtyard, has a private employees area where staff can shower and change into fresh clothes before leaving campus. Countryside has also activated a new means of communicating the latest information on the COVID-19 outbreak with residents, family members, loved ones, and the greater community. A pre-recorded phone line that will be updated each day at 3 p.m. To hear the latest, call 971-900-9894. Seniors and those with underlying medical conditions are at much higher risk for serious repercussions or death from COVID-19, the respiratory illness caused by the new coronavirus. Despite statewide efforts to protect those at higher risk, the disease has taken its toll. As of Sunday, all but 6 of the state's 91 COVID-related deaths have been Oregonians aged 60 or older. Approximately half of them residents at long-term care facilities. The Attorney General's office has sent the mayor of Oregon City a letter threatening criminal and civil action. This was over claims that the mayor planned to allow businesses to reopen in violation of Governor Kate Brown's stay-at-home order. Mayor Dan Holliday's supposed plans were based on his mistaken belief that the governor lacked the legal authority to force businesses to close during a state of emergency, according to the April 24th letter signed by Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. Rosenblum's letter lays out the various legal statute that she says supports the governor's authority to enact a state of emergency in response to a pandemic and, during a state of emergency, to take various actions to protect public health, including closing or restricting businesses. It also sets forth what she described as the governor's authority to utilize all police powers to effect her state of emergency declaration, as well as enforce state laws that protect the public's health, safety, and general welfare. Violating the governor's stay-at-home rule or any executive order issued through her emergency powers could lead to criminal or civil penalties, Rosenblum said. So, in addition to putting your residents' health at risk, you may be placing them in legal jeopardy, she said. My hope is that this letter will persuade you to abandon this approach. Please be advised I will take legal action, civil or criminal, as appropriate, in order to protect the public. Reached on Saturday, Mayor Holliday said he had made no formal decision on the matter. But he admitted he has been talking with other mayors in the region, as well as business owners and residents in both Canby and Oregon City, about the possibility of allowing businesses to reopen and people to go back to work, with or without the approval of the state government. We had been discussing some options, but we had not chosen a particular course, Holliday said. Then I get this really shocking letter telling me what I was planning on doing, even though I hadn't told anybody I was planning on doing it, that I should cease and desist. Just for the record, Holliday said he does believe the governor may have overstepped her authority by continuing the state of emergency and social distancing orders now that it's clear that the threat of the novel coronavirus to the state of Oregon is not as great as it initially seemed. At least, that's the way he sees it. I think we need to get back to data and facts, Holliday said. If you go back 4 or 5 weeks, I do not fault any of the actions the governor took shutting stuff down, because the information they had then was that this could all be really deadly. And even though it has been deadly, it hasn't been nearly as deadly as the early predictions. So the question is, how long do we keep killing small and medium-sized businesses around the state to stop something that is not as dangerous as we thought? The issue, Mayor Holliday said, based on his lengthy research and discussions with local attorneys and other experts, is whether the circumstances still warrant the governor's continued use of her emergency powers. And he admit he might be willing to press the issue. I haven't decided what I'm going to do. I've got folks looking at things this weekend. Then I'll make a decision, he said. I've been doing this all my life. I'm not afraid of a fight. To read the full copy of the letter by Attorney General Rosenblum, find this story on our website at cambynowpod.com. To hear more, Mayor Holliday, well, just stay tuned. Oregon lawmakers on Thursday approved a $32 million emergency aid package. The package, aimed at helping renters, workers, small businesses, and survivors of domestic violence that have been impacted by the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. The Joint Emergency Board of the Oregon Legislature also gave Governor Kate Brown the authority to spend up to $300 million in federal aid the state had received to address the COVID-19 crisis. Of the state funding package the E-Board passed this week, $12 million will go towards rent assistance and motel vouchers for disadvantaged communities. The lion's share of this, $8.5 million, will go directly to residential landlords to secure the housing of renters earning 50% or less than the area's median income. The remainder will pay for hotel or motel rooms for farm workers and other housing insecure groups. About a third of the approximately $32.5 million package will create a wage replacement fund for workers unemployed because of the coronavirus and who are unable to access unemployment payments because of immigration status or other reasons. With the help of matching funds from Oregon Business, $10 million will be disbursed in financial assistance to small businesses that haven't been able to access federal aid, such as the Paycheck Protection Program. The Paycheck Protection Program ran out of money in less than 2 weeks, though a second round of funding has been approved by Congress. The program was also criticized for allowing large publicly traded chains like Shake Shack and Ruth's Chris Steakhouse to gobble up hundreds of millions of dollars that had been earmarked specifically for struggling small businesses. State lawmakers also approved $3.35 million to help workers in long-term care facilities pay for coronavirus testing and offer caregivers training in infectious disease prevention. $2 million for survivors of domestic and sexual violence will be dispersed by dozens of partnering organizations around the state and is primarily intended to address housing needs. House Democrat leader Barbara Smith Warren of Portland applauded the bipartisan effort. "We are all in this together, regardless of our party or where we live," Representative Smith Warren said. "And today, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as Oregonians, we took a critically important step to support frontline workers, domestic abuse survivors, and small business owners." Her counterpart, House Republican leader Christine Drazen of Canby, who also serves on the E-Board, also hailed the package. But Drazen said the state still must do more to support small businesses and working families. "Direct support of Oregonians is valuable and necessary, but it is the long-term stability that comes from holding on to a job that keeps the stress and fear of this economic crisis from taking over a heart and a home," Representative Drazen said. "We cannot ignore the value of a balanced approach in responding to this crisis. Investment in Oregon businesses are investments in the lives of Oregonians." Perhaps one of the few good things to come out of the COVID-19 crisis is the spotlight it has shown on the nation's essential workers, from doctors and nurses to grocery clerks to first responders and more. These are the folks who can't close up shop or work safely from home who continue to show up day in and day out because we need them to. People generally understand first responder to be an all-inclusive term. It includes police officers, sheriff deputies, emergency medical technicians, and firefighters. But one critical link in the chain is often left out: 911 dispatchers. Earlier this month, the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners took action to change that, passing a proclamation recognizing the important work of their 911 call takers, dispatchers, technicians, trainers, supervisors, and administrators, and declaring them first responders. In doing so, Clackamas became the first county in Oregon to honor 911 employees as first responders. In the past year alone, Clackamas County 911, known as CCOM, answered more than 269,000 emergency and non-emergency calls for residents in the county, while providing support and resources for more than 245,000 dispatch events, including law enforcement incidents, fires, and emergency medical services. All CCOM staff are also trained in emergency medical dispatch, allowing them to offer potentially life-saving instructions, including CPR, bleeding control, choking, childbirth, and airway maintenance over the telephone until paramedics arrive on the scene. Despite their training and their work, the federal government classifies 911 telecommunicators as administrative or clerical staff, as opposed to a protective services occupation. This misclassification stems from the olden days, when 911 dispatchers were primarily switchboard operators who would take a call and simply patch it through to a police or fire station. The job has changed a lot in the past 40 years, but the U.S. Department of Labor hasn't caught up yet. Clackamas County has supported a national resolution, the 911 Saves Act, that would change this designation, but it has stalled in both chambers of Congress since March of last year. Governor Kate Brown announced she will allow healthcare providers to resume scheduling non-emergency and elective surgeries and other procedures as long as they demonstrate they have met her new requirements for COVID-19 safety and preparedness. Those requirements include having adequate personal protective equipment, PPE, to minimize the risk of coronavirus transmission to patients and healthcare workers, and maintaining adequate hospital capacity in the event of a surge of new cases. Hospitals, surgical centers, medical offices, and dental offices that meet those requirements will be able to resume non-urgent procedures as early as May 1st. Under the framework, hospitals must continue to report PPE supply levels daily to the Oregon Health Authority. Hospitals must also demonstrate adequate COVID-19 testing capacity when needed, including the ability to screen patients before non-urgent procedures and follow strict infection control protocols. Facilities that are ready to begin resuming non-urgent procedures will be required to do so gradually in order to preserve the capacity to treat COVID-19 patients, the governor said. As anyone waiting for an elective surgery knows, non-urgent does not mean minor, Governor Brown said. This is incredibly important medical care that we would not have told providers to delay if the threat of COVID-19 had not made it necessary. She went on to thank affected Oregonians for the sacrifice, which she said was to ensure that healthcare workers had adequate support and supplies they need to treat COVID-19 patients. Lifting this order will allow our healthcare system to get up and running again, with appropriate safeguards in place, so that Oregonians can get healthcare treatment without delay, Brown said. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. That, again, was the message from Canby leaders during a live-streamed community update Wednesday night, as those calling for an economic reopening have grown in number and volume at the state and local level. People on both sides of the debate in Canby got new ammunition recently. Residents supporting the continued stay-at-home order point to Canby's first confirmed outbreak in a senior care facility as evidence that the novel coronavirus is still a looming and active threat, and we must do whatever we can to protect those most vulnerable. While those in favor of a more or less immediate reopening lament the permanent closure of Salon L, a well-established hair studio downtown, and say it is only the first of many unless something changes soon. The most vocal, sometimes using the hashtag OpenOregon on social media, are urging businesses to reopen and workers to return to work as of May 1st. They point to Oregon's relatively low numbers of COVID-19 cases and deaths as evidence that the threat in our state is not nearly as serious as experts claim, and that Governor Kate Brown's orders were overkill. And yet, they appear to be the clear minority, for now. A Facebook poll by the Canby Now podcast indicates that over 63% of local residents support the governor's stay-at-home order and plans for reopening, with more than 1,000 votes cast as of Sunday. On Wednesday night, Mayor Brian Hodson and Canby Area Chamber Director Kyle Lang addressed the growing Open Oregon movement. They expressed sympathy and understanding, while ultimately disagreeing with their suggested course. I see the devastation this is having in our community, and that this is having on our families, Mayor Hodson said. I want to see Canby get back to normal, or to whatever the new normal will be. Businesses open and people enjoying those businesses, being out of the park and enjoying our open spaces. In a time of deep polarization, when the discussion of complex subjects cannot be reduced to memes and pointed barbs on social media, Lang said it's not about two sides being right or wrong. It's about balance.
I, like many of you, see many messages on social media that polarizes the issue of reopening the Oregon economy. The hows and the whys, or why nots, and I want to say simply this. It is possible to hold two ideas in one's head simultaneously. It is possible to be concerned about community health and about the impacts of COVID-19 crisis at the same time. It is about balance, about purposeful and deliberate action that works to solve both problems with as little damage and as little delay as possible. None of these decisions are easy, and we ask for your patience as the possibilities are explored.
Both Lang and Hodson discussed the more detailed draft framework for Oregon's reopening release by Governor Brown's office this week. The framework sets forth a phased approach contingent upon areas first showing declining case numbers while also demonstrating preparedness to handle any possible surge. Her office and advisory councils have also opened dialogue about what a phased approach would look like in a specific sector of the economy, such as food service and personal care. They suggest that though restaurants, hair salons, and other businesses may be allowed to reopen, certain restrictions and guidelines will remain. The complete details of the governor's framework, including operational plans and geographic criteria, and a step-by-step plan for Oregon's reopening, is expected the week of May 4th.
Canby, DirectLink is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at DirectLink are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, I mean, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
We'd like to extend our undying gratitude to Canby Now Plus member Sarah Paris. We rely on your monthly contributions to continue to do this work that we love. To find out how you can become one of the coolest people in the world, one of our supporters on Patreon, visit canbynowpod.com/plus.
The idea of reopening and restarting an economy ravished by the COVID-19 shutdown has risen to the forefront of discussion at the local, state, and national levels recently. While a permanent cure for the threat posed by the novel coronavirus remains months or even years away, there is a growing chorus saying that the long-term impacts from shutting down so many segments of the economy could be even more devastating to many businesses, workers, and families. Joining us on the Canby Conversation today to continue that discussion are two mayors from neighboring cities. We have Dan Holliday, mayor of Oregon City and also a small business owner in downtown Canby. Welcome, Dan.
Hello.
And Brian Hodson, mayor of Canby. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Delighted to have this discussion today. I wanted to start, Dan, before we turn the recorder on, there is a little bit of breaking news over in your neck of the woods. It's obviously very relevant and pertinent to this discussion. Can you start by telling us and the listeners about it?
Yeah, yesterday afternoon around 5:45, I got an email from an executive assistant to governor, to the Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, with a letter basically telling me to cease and desist. I had been having some discussions with mayors, not only around the metro area, but around the, region about, how we were going to move forward through this, and had been discussing some options, but had not fallen on, had not chosen a particular course.
Right.
And I got this really shocking letter, actually, telling me that you know, what I was planning on doing, even though I hadn't told anybody what I was planning on doing, and that I should cease and desist.
Yeah.
Threatening me with either civil or criminal sanctions.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, all I did was exercise my First Amendment right to have a discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is, to the listeners, this is going to feel a little bit meta because we're having this discussion very in the moment and I'm kind of getting a reaction from you. By the time they're listening to this, because you've sent us a letter, we've already done a news story that folks have heard earlier in this podcast talking about it. Yeah, I'm just getting from you, Dan, kind of the feelings of you know, just where did this come from? This feels very unfair. You've been a civil servant for a long time as a mayor and I believe city councilor as well as Oregon City. You worked on a number of regional task force and things in the area. And to just get this letter out of the blue based apparently on hearsay doesn't feel very good just as a person.
Well, no, I would have, you know, like I said, I'm not a far right bomb thrower. You know, I've worked with people from all across the aisle. I have a great working relationship with the county commission. And I would have expected, you know, a phone call or an email saying, hey, can we, you know, have a chat about what you're thinking about rather than just, you know, looking up in the sky and seeing the nuclear warhead falling.
Right. Or seeing the bat signal and they had to swoop into action or whatever right. prompted this.
I guess the only worst thing would be if they had just, you know, knocked in my door and arrested me with, you know, a SWAT team.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Brian, let's loop you in on this. Obviously, this is an Oregon City issue and not necessarily something that you were involved in, but I think that you, when we've been talking about it, how this, the different things that Dan has been talking about, I don't know if when he mentioned talking to other mayors, if you were part of that or whatnot, but it's certainly all of this stuff is stuff that you've been having, I know, many discussions on and conversations about, and probably have some opinions about what we're talking about right here. Why don't you give us a few of your thoughts?
Well, I just, again, like I think it, as we were stating before we kind of got the recording, I just think this goes to, speaks to the battle that's kind of going on right now.
Yeah.
Right. Do we get, you know, do we open when, and if so, how, mm-hmm. And when do we do that piece of it? And so there's that dialogue that's occurring amongst the business community, amongst the cities and counties. And I just think that, you know, to have the attorney general reach out like that and come after a mayor, that's investigating or having the dialogue about it isn't, I just think that speaks to just how maybe hardline things are regarding this topic.
It's so complicated, right? I mean, like, and we're going to obviously figure it out here in the next 20 minutes and make it real clear for people, right? but I mean, it touches on the economy. There's public health concerns, obviously, at the center of this. Constitutional issues, whose authority weighs in where and whatnot. I mean, like, how smart and how knowledgeable do you have to be to make sense of this crazy situation we're all going through right now?
Well, you know, I think we need to get back to looking at basic data and facts.
Yeah.
And if we go back 4 or 5 weeks ago, I do not fault any of the governors or the president's actions about shutting stuff down, because the information that they had then, this could have been, you know, really a deadly thing. And even though it has been, you know, deadly, it hasn't been nearly as deadly as the early predictions are. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think if we look at some of the studies that are coming out of New York and LA and other places, that this disease was actually substantially more infectious than they thought it was, but also it's not nearly as deadly as they thought. I think they were, at the beginning, they were thinking it was going to be 3 or 4 times more deadly than the seasonal flu. And now it's looking more and more like it's less deadly than the seasonal flu. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how long do we, you know, keep killing small businesses or small and medium-sized businesses around the state to stop something that, you know, really, at least in my opinion, looking at all the data, and I watch CNN and Fox and MSNBC, and I read the Wall Street Journal and New York Times and the Oregonian, and I take a lot of information from a lot of different places, but it's becoming clear to me that this thing is not is not as dangerous as we thought. And it's particularly really only dangerous to folks that are in their, you know, late 60s to and up. And then especially kids, you know, aren't being affected by it at all that we can see. I don't know of a single death under 18 in the entire country.
Well, certainly not here in Oregon.
No, definitely not. Well, and the other argument too that's been going on, Frankie, has been the question of testing. You know, we have as a state have 10,000 tests ready to go, but we as a state have not done nearly the amount of testing on a percentage level that Washington and California have. So if the argument is that there's more cases out there or suspected cases, then let's get those confirmed.
Yeah.
If not, then the governor needs to be having some serious conversation about her strategy. What's different? What's, you know, how do we look at counties that don't have any cases and get them open if they can do it?
Yeah.
And I think that could be a good test barometer of where things are at. Dan and I have been on, an ad nauseum amount of calls probably here this last week with between League of Oregon Cities, the governor's office, metro mayors, our own counselors, neighboring mayors. I mean, it's been a plethora of phone calls out and about. And I think that we've got to figure out a way to what's the appropriate path. I think the timeline the governor has laid out, it's too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand being cautious, but I think it's too long.
Well, and I totally understand the frustration of the businesses and the elected officials that you guys are all dealing with. I think that what is so difficult about this question, about this issue, is the invisible nature of it, right? Like, we don't see the virus. The cases take, you know, several days before symptoms show. They can be contagious during that whole time. We have a very low number of cases that you talked about, Dan, but was that because of the aggressive steps that were taken to prevent it? Or was it because Oregon has such a lower population density than places like New York City or California? It's actually hypothetical.
I think you missed on both counts there. I think what really happened is this thing came earlier than anybody thought.
Mm-hmm.
They're finding cases earlier and earlier in December now, and that it spread far and wide, but very few people actually really got sick.
Mm-hmm.
So the studies coming out of especially LA, where they have some 30,000 cases, the estimates are there's over 300,000 people that have had the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we start to do these antibody studies, I think we're going to find that a great majority of the popular, or at least a large percentage of the population, has already been infected and either is asymptomatic or has, you know, gone through what would maybe they thought was just a common cold.
Yeah. I mean, but should we wait until those studies actually come in before we make big reopening decisions based on?
No, we can't wait. If we wait another month.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Betty's business. We have a great landlord who's working with us, but there are many other landlords around Canby and Oregon City and across the state who own mortgages of their own. So yeah. They can't forgive rent payments.
Sure.
Sure. While the cities are probably not, we're not shutting off water. The utilities aren't shutting off the utilities, but at some point all those bills are going to come due. So the longer we wait to give people the opportunity to work, the much deeper it's going to take to get out of it. Brian, what do you think?
What do you think? That's what I was going to say. Yeah, let's hear from Mayor of Canby over there.
No, so and that's the ongoing dialogue, right? So, I've got businesses that are closed entirely, right? So, I was talking with Councilor Varwig on my way into town from work the other day, and you drive along, and I couple times a week I drive through downtown. And it is. It's heartbreaking to see at 7 o'clock at night that, in essence, our downtown and our city is virtually shut down.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I drive through and I'm talking to him and I'm like, okay, so who's not open? Right? I mean, Dutch Brothers is open. Starbucks is open on a limited time. Safeway is open. Oddmo's Pizza is open. Backstop is open, albeit limited. Wayward Sandwiches is open, limited basis. You know, it's really like hair salons, bars, tattoo parlors. You know, Jamie Stickle, our economic development director, and I were talking, and, you know, most of the businesses in the Canby Pioneer Industrial Park are indeed open.
Yeah.
And running shifts. Is it full capacity? No, it's not. Do I want to see be able to see, you know, people go to the Wild Hare and sit and have a drink and hang out at their bar and or the backstop? Absolutely. So the question is like, how much more needs to get rolling and open? I was talking to one hair salon owner this week, and they're really concerned about trying to buck that trend of not opening, because they're still concerned about the virus and what's, you know, we hairstylists, you know, impede that 6-foot barrier with every client that they have. So how do they function as a business? You know, I don't know. So
shouldn't that be a function of each individual business owner making a decision? Can I be safe doing my job? Why is the, at this point in this process, now that we're down the road 5 or 6 weeks, why is the state still telling us what we can and can't do?
Well, and Dan, and that's where the crux is. I think, you know, we look at it. It's what's the actual threat, and what's, you know, there's the panic set of what if. Then there's the, well, I want to be cautious. And then there's the, you know, I think there's a scale, like where are we at on that scale? And I think right now the governor's office is still on that. It's still, we could still have a massive pandemic in the state of Oregon if we open too quickly. Okay. But we've got areas of our state that don't have any cases. How do we stagger that opening? That's the piece to me. Like, I think that there's got to be a staged way to open up, you know, some of these other counties, measure it, see if there's an increase of any kind, and what does that look like?
Yeah.
And I think that also this fantasy of testing and contact tracing at this point is, you know, that bird flew the coop a long time ago. You know, people have been going to Home Depot and Lowe's and Safeway and Fred Meyer for weeks, you know, nose to tail before they started doing distancing at the grocery stores. That's only been going on for a week or so. This thing is already spread out. There's no way to put that genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Dan, to that point, right? So you have these large, like, most nights when I leave, unfortunately, after most businesses are closed, but the rare occasion I do get to leave work. So for those that are listening, I work in I'm a director at an adult retirement community. And so I'm there. I have to be there, you know, almost every day in that environment. And so for me, being in that situation has probably made me more cautious overall.
Yeah, the more vulnerable population that you're serving potentially.
Well, and Frankie, you're monitoring that as well through the VA and your job, and mm-hmm. you know, so has that made me more cautious and hypersensitive? Yeah, it has, because at the end of the day, my employees, you know, my nurses and caregivers leave, and I have no control over where they go. Mm-hmm. So they go right now, maybe they go directly home, or they go to the grocery store and then go home.
Yeah.
So they're limited where they can go, where they can get exposed and then bring it into my building. And we saw it at Countryside Living. I, you know, was talking with Eric Berkey the other day, and they've, you know, they've followed the state issued protocol. you know, and then they still end up getting a case or a couple of cases. So I'm trying to balance that hypersensitivity to that end of it versus what's the reality and what's going on in the real world. We have to do that with flu season, because flu season becomes norovirus season in our world and in the adult community world, where we've got to lock down our building for that, because that's as bad as this may be. So I'm trying to take it through that lens as well, but also looking at, like, to your point, Dan, you know, if people are going to be coming out and they're going to, instead of taking their lunch to go from Wayward, decide to pull out a chair and sit down, is the owner of Wayward going to ask them to leave? I don't know. I suppose that's on his call. You know,
well, and I think what you just said really rings a bell for me. And that is that if we have testing, the testing should be being done at your facility with your people, your staff. You should know whether they've either A, had it or haven't had it, or whether they do have it. Mm-hmm. That's where the testing and contact tracing should be happening.
I 100% agree with that, Dan. I mean, I'm in a different building, but my previous building that I was working at, one of the members of the administrative team came down with COVID. So there was a possibility that I was exposed to it. Mm-hmm. So I had to go and get tested. They tested everyone in the building. And since I was there during that window of time, I was tested, came back negative. But I agree. The state rushed in 50 tests to test all of the staff members. And, you know, fortunately we found out that there were additional staff members that had the virus, and we were able to clamp it down and do what we needed to do. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you that that's where we've got to start, is on that front, is, you know, in our retirement communities and in our hospitals. So
I guess my point is that there is a place for this, you know, serious lockdown, but it's not the general public. The place for that is the places that have the most vulnerable population. So retirement homes, assisted living, memory care facilities, hospitals, you know, those are the places that we should be concerned about, and let the rest of the people go back to work.
Right, right. And I think that people, everyone's on board with that, right? No one's saying, let's not protect the most vulnerable. Let's not protect our seniors or our folks who are immunocompromised. And I think that what I'm hearing from you, Dan, is that just this is not the best way to do that, of just locking down, especially like very specific sectors of the economy. Joining us once again on the Can Be Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
You know, it's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. You know, interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So
wow.
You know, we're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, you know, spreading the virus and whatnot. But yeah, everything's still moving along.
Well, so how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com. But just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right. You as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
So I hear you on that, Dan, that may, like, yes, let's protect those who are most vulnerable, but the current system maybe is not the best way to do that. Maybe there are better ways, right?
Well, and since you bring up unemployment, you know, the state's had $87 million since 2009 to fix the unemployment system computers, and they haven't done it. So now they're hiring 70-year-old COBOL and Fortran programmers to come in and try to help them, you know, patch together this mainframe from the mid-1980s. You know, Microsoft is only a couple hundred miles away. Intel is right down the street. You're telling me that some bright kid couldn't have made an app for that by now? It's just stupid.
Okay. Let's, you know, one crisis at a time. Let's deal with COVID and then we can try to fix the state government, right? Let's come back to Canby. We've had a good discussion, I think. Canby, Oregon City area, sort of where we go from here, where I feel like we've kind of landed a little bit is clearly there are disagreements from businesses, from our local elected officials about how things are being done on the state, maybe even national level. Where does that rubber kind of meet the road here in our communities when the authority lines are the authorities are in disagreement about even where the authority lays or where how we move forward? Where do we go from here in terms of our local communities and the folks who live here in Canby and Oregon City?
Well, so Tyler, I'll address some of that, and Dan, please chime in. So on Thursday, there was Dan and I belong to attend a regional mayors group called the Metro Mayors Consortium. Mm-hmm. And so that's made up of all the mayors really kind of in the Portland metro area. And we get together every month, various issues tackle or try to influence and kind of become our own lobby group for the mayor's perspective. So it's, you know, so mayors from, you know, Hillsborough and Gresham and Canby and Oregon City and Portland and, you know, and we include the mayor from Vancouver in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I brought the topic up at our meeting on Thursday about what's everyone's thoughts on, you know, the May 1st, May Day, Open Oregon, you know, conversation. And it was crickets. None of the mayors seemed to really be real anxious or interested in trying to tackle, you know, going against the executive order of the governor.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Like that's, you know, but, you know, to not, are they having those conversations? Probably. Like I've reached out to our city attorney and am having dialogue about where does that rest within the scope of, you know, the mayor and or city council. What does that look like? I'm having conversations with the city council about that as well.
Yeah.
But it does come back down to, you know, looking at the law of the land is what the governor with what they have done. Does the power for the governor to do what she has done, does it rest with her via the state constitution and, you know, through Oregon regulations? Dan might be able to speak to that better than I can. You know, it seems that she's acting within the scope of that. I could be wrong on that. But, you know, there's pieces for us as cities that, you know, there's certain actions that we can take where we're going to then bump up against that executive order ceiling. And then what does that look like? Is it move beyond just letters from the state attorney general into something more? And do we want to take on that battle individually? Or is there a collective that's being put together to just say, hey, help us out here, governor, let's get this figured out.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That battle. I mean, what authority does the state government have? And this is kind of the place Dan might be in, but like, is it worth that fight? Even if you believe necessarily that they don't, but they're going to push you on it. And there might be, you know, the consequences that were talked about in that letter. Like, is it necessarily worth it? Is there maybe a better way forward that will still accomplish some of your goals? I don't know, Dan. I mean, where are you kind of at with that?
Well, you know, leadership is the act of taking action, not mm-hmm. sitting around. And the legal advice that I have gotten is that while the governor certainly had the authority to do what she did 5 or 6 weeks ago, that that authority rests on some pretty sound constitutional principles then, but they don't necessarily meet those constitutional principles now. Mm. So constitutionally, the government is required to use the least restrictive method in order to deal with whatever the public function is they're trying to do.
Right.
And we're way past the least restrictive at this point, given the facts that we know on the ground. So, you know, I haven't decided what I'm going to do. I've got folks looking at, you know, things this weekend, and then I'll make a decision. I've been doing this all my life. I'm not afraid of a fight. I prefer not to, because I think if, you know, rather than sending me a letter, if someone had called and said, hey, can we sit down and talk? Can we have a video conference? Can I hear what your concerns are? That it wouldn't necessarily had to come to this. But I don't want to see, you know, moms being arrested in the park. I don't think that constitutionally we have the right to tell people they can't go to church. I think that's a very dangerous, you know, slope to go down.
Do you have an outlook, Brian, just as far as where we're going from here in Canby, in terms of the businesses and workers that are hurting right now, who may feel that this the current situation is it not working for them either, and they really want to change regardless of what the current guidance, you know, is from the state government?
Well, I'm kind of in, what am I going to do? I'm the same boat that Dan's in terms of, like, you know, what are the pieces that are there? Like, you know, I need the guidance piece from the city attorney, you know, in terms of, like, what does that do? Where does the authority rest with us as mayors and city councilors? That's the piece that we've got to do. I want to see businesses get open. I want to see the governor, you know, move quicker on some of these decision pieces than what's been happening. I think we have the data out there to show us where we're at right now. And if, you know, we can get open and then, you know, yes, I err on the side of caution. Is there an approach to get us open, and can that happen in a week? Probably not. Do I see things moving where I would like to see parts of our state open up? And that would give some encouragement to the business community and what's going on, that can show us what's really going on in terms of the virus and if they're still spreading and at what rate that would look like. So, you know, I that's kind of where I'm at right now. Yeah, I'm still cautious. You know, yeah, the numbers are what they are, and I want to make sure that, will this ever fully go away? It won't. We're going to have to make a decision, to me, sooner than later, about getting open and see where we're at.
Do you think people should still listen to public health officials and things, people that are scared, who are...
Well, that's the beauty of it. If somebody is, you know, if somebody's in that camp, they're more than welcome to stay home. Nobody's forcing them to go out and do anything. That's the beauty of the United States of America, is we still have freedom of choice. We can make those kinds of decisions. And I guess the one thing that, you know, I would ask Brian, I'm certainly not interested in doing any kind of enforcement. So if a business decides to open in Oregon City against the governor's order, who's going to enforce that? Because it's certainly not going to be me.
Well, and that's part of the conversation too, Dan. Like, so can you tell your police officers and your chief to stand down and not enforce it? So if you can, you know, police forces ultimately report into the state, you know, Oregon State Police Department. So how does that then trickle down? If someone decides to call, you know, Canby PD or Oregon City PD, and we do a drive-by and do an educational visit, you know, to that business, and it continues, then does it elevate to, OSP or the governor's office or OSHA.
My understanding is that this has been a discussion at the level of the state chiefs of police.
Okay.
And that they are advising extreme caution.
Okay. So much like most of the mayors in this western part of the metro area is a state of caution.
Well, I think the thing is the cops just don't want to be in that business.
Right.
Oh, sure. And I don't want to put, and that's the other piece too, is do I want my police officers, a couple of things.
No, I don't.
Do I want my police officers that are, live in and around my city and to go in and have to play the heavy on someone, and their livelihood?
Right.
I don't want to put them in that position.
Yeah.
I don't want to put them in that position of exposure. Right. I mean, that there's that piece as well. Right. So we had to have that conversation as a city, city manager and I, about what's our contingency. If all of a sudden we get officers that have are contagious and we have to put officers on leave, what is that going to look like from a public safety standpoint? So I'm not real excited about putting our police officers in that position. Now, when it was first put out there, yes, I know our police officers stopped by a couple of businesses, just a handful, to do social distancing conversations and just education. And that was it. And that's all that I wanted them to do. I don't want them levying fines. I don't want any of that going on. Yeah, I think it's good that the state chiefs group is saying, hey, let's act with caution. That's a different level of execution for sure. You know, what is it? Some people like, great, we have a resurgence of the brown shirts,
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that, this whole thing works because the people of the United States said, okay, we see this as a serious threat, so we'll take this seriously. But now as the weeks have gone on and they're starting to see that it's really not that big a threat, now you're going to start to see that dichotomy of, okay, some businesses are going to say, screw it, I'm going to open up. And then comes the question of, how does the governor or the state enforce these mandates when you start to get people that are being civilly disobedient?
So if that does happen and it becomes like a $1,200 a day fine, to some businesses like, no, I can cover it. If I'm open, I can cover that every day. Okay. Then I guess that's the decision that needs to be made. I think citizenry, like we said, those that are still cautious won't go out. Those that want to get open and want to get active, then great. Let's, civil disobedience. Well, let's apply the pressure appropriately. What are those messages and emails and letters that can be written and phone calls that can be made? I've had a conversation earlier with Representative Drazen, and she's in the thick of it as, party leader there in Salem. And so she's in there and she's hearing it from all angles as well. And so she's trying to fight through all of this and work with the governor's office to get things moving in the appropriate direction and with the right amount of cautiousness. So I think there's a lot of conversations going on aimed directly at the governor's office to have this move in a quicker fashion as appropriate.
Well, we're clearly in a place where there's a lot of tension, a lot of frustration. I know I'm getting a little worried even as this conversation continues. Visions of police officers hauling Mallory Gwynn out of Gwynn's coffee house or whatnot. I know none of us want anything like that.
I'd pay to see that.
Make a good video, I have to say. But
well, let's have that happen in Oregon City first. I don't want that in the
But yeah, I mean, obviously this has gone on and on as we've been talking, as you said, Dan, the frustrations are going to continue to mount. I, ultimately, though, I think, and I even hear from you guys, a lot of common ground. We want to get these businesses back open. We want people to stay healthy. We may not agree on exactly how big the threat is, but ultimately we do agree. We want people to stay safe and we want to protect those most vulnerable. So I certainly just hope we are able to continue to have those discussions and communications and continue to listen to each other as much as possible, even with the frustrations, even with the tensions. I think as long as we can keep listening to each other and trying to understand each other, we can avoid hopefully some ugly scenes, because we are such strong communities. And I think that ultimately that's what's going to help see us through.
Right. And I guess that was the most disconcerting thing about the letter from the Attorney General, is that, you know, I have always been willing to sit down and talk to people on the other side. We've had a long problem with the wastewater between Gladstone, Oregon City, and Clackamas County. And we spent a year and we got to an agreement because we sat down and talked about it. And so to be just go from, you know, having discussions with fellow elected officials to, you know, a nasty gram from the Attorney General, seemed like there was a lot of space for some kind of discussion in between those two things.
That escalated quickly, right?
Well, and I think there's a lot of, you know, some of the positive pieces here, right? So I think the fact that the governor actually put out a plan to get open was good to see this past week, last weekend. I think the fact that they're moving forward with hospitals and doctor's offices, I think going into, or maybe it's just the hospitals doing, getting back to open and kind of some sense of normalcy there.
Doctor's offices, dental offices.
Those are positive signs to me in that. I'm still disheartened that the governor's office and the economic team weren't rigorously meeting at the outset of this to be prepared for getting open sooner. I know that, you know, Dan and I, with our city's staffs and whatnot, have having this conversation within, you know, a week of having the stay home order, we're having conversations of what do we do coming out of this? What can we be doing and be prepared for our cities to help our businesses get back open? And how do we not only help them get back open, but how do we help them sustain getting back open? Because the recovery piece to this isn't going to be instantaneous. It's going to be drawn out. And so businesses don't need just help now. They're going to need help after they open. And what is that? What can we as cities do? And I know Dan's been having that conversation with his staff. I've been doing that with mine as well. So there are pieces that we are doing here at the ground level that will help when we do get back open.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just a matter of flipping a switch, right? There are ways that, you know, once that clearance does happen, or however it happens, there are ways that it can still sort of be kickstarted or not. And we want to have you do that as much as possible, right?
Right. We're having a special meeting on Monday to discuss a grant program in Oregon City. We've got about $200,000 that the we're going to try to figure out how we can help as many small businesses in Oregon City as we can.
Yeah. That'll just all go to Ruth Chris, though, wouldn't it?
We're limiting it to employers with 15 employees or less.
Okay, cool.
That's great.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, well, thank you guys so much. I spent all this time doing all these questions and outlining the discussion. I think we used none of them, but... I think it was a good chat. I really appreciate your guys' work. I know that it's not, your jobs are not easy, and especially in these types of situations. I know the hours have been long, the challenges have been great, so I really appreciate you and all of our elected officials that work with you and our city staffs and all those folks as well.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Frankie. Appreciate it. Dan, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank all you, right. sir.
Hang in there, guys.
We'll talk soon.
See ya.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City.
The coronavirus has changed much about how the wild hare does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hare is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hare's friendly staff will be there to handle your carry-out orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.